From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Madeline Brand. In California, Harry Potter's magic is working again. The Half-Blood Prince, that's the sixth Harry Potter movie, opened this Wednesday with the best first-day ticket numbers of the series. It made more than $58 million on its first day.
You're the chosen one, Harry.
You have to realize who you are.
Without you, we'd leave the fate of our world to chance.
Well, The Boy Wizard is an exception to the rule this summer. While the season started strong with movies like Up, Star Trek, and the latest Transformers, the season is cooling down, and it's only July. John Horn covers the movie industry for the Los Angeles Times. He's written about this trend. And I'm just wondering, we're in July, how badly are the box office numbers doing?
It's not that they're doing badly. It's that they're not doing nearly as well as they were at the beginning of the year. There are a lot of movies in the spring that did exceptionally well. Paul Blart, Taken would be two good examples. At a certain point, according to some estimates, the box office was running about 17% ahead of what it was a year ago, and now it's about 11%. So it has cooled off dramatically.
I thought the conventional wisdom has been that during a recession, people go to the movies. So why aren't they?
Well, they are. They just aren't going as much as they did at the beginning of the year. And I think what's really changed is they're not going just out of habit anymore. I think the audience is asking a lot more of movies than they have in recent years. So you look at a movie like Eddie Murphy's Imagine That or Will Ferrell's Land of the Lost. I mean, those are movies that maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years ago might have worked. Let's go see the new Eddie Murphy family comedy. And now you have what the business calls complete concept rejection, where the movies don't even open. They don't even get any business on a Friday. So I think the audience is becoming a little bit more picky, and they're much more interested in what their friends are recommending than what critics are recommending.
John, talk about marketing movies these days and what's changed, because it seems that marketing failed almost with Bruno, because you couldn't walk 2 feet without seeing a Bruno ad, and yet it's not doing as well as its backers had hoped.
The movie business is driven by two concepts. One is marketability, how much an audience is aware of a known franchise. You know, it's the next John Grisham book, it's the next Harry Potter movie, it's a Spider-Man. Do you know what it is before you go in? And the second one is playability, whether or not audiences come out of a theater recommending the movie to their friends, whether they enjoy seeing it. And Bruno had a lot of marketability. I mean, Borat was a successful film, I think. People knew who Sacha Baron Cohen was. And yet when the movie opened on Friday, it was very obvious from looking at the numbers that people came out of that movie, if not in the middle of it, and started texting or Twittering their friends and telling them that it wasn't any good. So from Friday to Saturday, Bruno fell off 40%, which is just unheard of. So what that says is that people came out of that movie and told their friends not to go see it. So when movies are not recommended by their friends, they fall faster than they've ever fallen.
So, John, that really puts a lot of pressure on movie studios, right?
Well, it puts pressure on them to make good movies, which seems like a strange idea. But as little as 2 years ago, the studios, even if they had a turkey, they would know that they could maybe get 2 weeks of business before the stink really caught up to the film. And now they have 12 hours. People will come out of a theater so quickly and share their opinion so fast, and that word will spread so virally, so quickly everywhere, that if a movie is bad, the audience will know it by Friday night, and the movie will be dead by Saturday.
John Horn is a movie reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you want to track the economic prospects of a nation, you don't need to spend so much time checking out its banking system, its debt ratios, or its stock prices. You can apparently learn a lot about a country just by checking the temperature. Look at a map, and it becomes clear. Poor countries tend to be close to the equator. Wealthier countries are in cooler climates. Hot equals poor. Cool equals rich. Many researchers say this is a historical accident, but a new study finds a strong link. Temperature really does have an effect on economic growth. NPR's David Kestenbaum with our Planet Money team reports.
This puzzle has been around for hundreds of years. The French writer Montesquieu thought about it way back in the 1700s. Of course, now we have a lot better data, and the numbers are striking. Ben Olken is an economist at MIT.
If you look at the data, every degree, 1 degree centigrade of higher average temperature reduces a country's per capita gross domestic product by about 8.5 percentage points.
That's a huge drop. He showed me a chart, and yup, cool places, Norway, Germany, France, the U.S., all strong economies. Then at the other end, there's poverty. Cambodia, Liberia, Congo.
It's a very, very strong line in the data. it really strikes you.
But who knows? It could be temperature, it could be the effects of colonialism, it could be just chance. So Okun and his colleagues said, look, let's forget about the differences between countries. Let's look within a country. Does a hot year hurt the economy? And they found something striking. In poor countries, a year that was, say, warmer by 1 degree centigrade, those years also had lower GDP by about 1%.
Which is an enormous magnitude. I mean, one might argue that the difference between kind of a recession, you know, where you have zero growth and a great economy that's buzzing along, maybe say 3% annual growth, that the 3 percentage points difference. So 1 degree centigrade explaining 1.1% percentage points, it's a really huge effect of temperature.
So a year that's, say, 1 degree warmer could be the difference between between a recession and a more normally growing economy.
That's right. That's right.
Now, it's unclear exactly why high temperatures would have this effect. It might be that crop yields go down or that disease is more of a problem. Or it might just be what you could call the sloth theory. It's hard to work when it's hot out. Who wants to mow the lawn in August?
This stuff is not implausible. If you look back at the U.S. before the advent of air conditioning, you know, there were times when the federal government would shut down because it was just too hot out. One of the takeaways that I have from this paper is it seems like the economic impacts of increased temperature in poor countries are going to be very severe.
Rich countries, by the way, their economies did not seem to be affected. Warm year, cold year, it didn't matter. Maybe because of air conditioning. William Easterly, an economist at NYU, says the new study is fascinating, but he is not convinced.
It's way too soon to just take one statistical finding and say we've solved a 500-year-old problem of why temperature and per capita income are associated with each other.
Easterly subscribes to a less numerical explanation.
Roughly speaking, goes something like this, that, you know, by some confluence of factors that we don't have to get into, it was sort of Europeans who discovered first how to set up a sort of prosperous market economy. And so they were the ones who kind of hit upon how to do that first.
This, he says, was the huge, important innovation. Why didn't the poorer countries catch up? Well, slavery is one reason.
Europe and America benefited from the profits of the slave trade, and Africa was obviously permanently harmed by the slave trade.
The good news, he says, is that there are some countries bucking the trend. Singapore is just about on the equator and doing quite well. Indonesia is growing fast. And for Easterly, this is the great hope of global trade. Cold or hot, countries can adapt and grow to overcome geography, climate, and eventually their history. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
The stars have realigned in the galaxy. We're talking soccer here, not astronomy. David Beckham has returned to the LA Galaxy Pro Soccer team after a stint with top Italian team AC Milan. Beckham is one of soccer's better players and its biggest star. But his past couple years with the Galaxy have produced losing seasons, hurt feelings, and now a tell-all book. It describes Beckham as a poor captain. NPR's Mike Pesca watched the Galaxy defeat the New York Red Bulls last night in New Jersey, and he sent this report.
Being a fan of David Beckham seems easy enough. He's a good-to-great player, a household name, self-effacing, a hard worker, and a winner. Perhaps the only hidden cost is the amount of closet space you have to devote to his many jerseys. There's Manchester United, Team England, Real Madrid, AC Milan. Last night, he redonned the LA Galaxy jersey in front of a sparsely populated Giant Stadium crowd. Each year, the Galaxy comes east to face the Red Bulls, and Vito Petrozelli has been in the stands for each of Beckham's appearances.
3 years ago, we had the entire stadium, every seat, filled. 2 years ago, very nice crowd, but first two levels, a sprinkling up top. This year, we'd be pretty lucky to say that the entire first level is filled.
Part of the explanation for the diminished excitement is that the home team is dreadful, as proved by last night's 3-0 halftime deficit, which Beckham had little to do with. But part of the explanation for the poor attendance is that the Beckham experiment hasn't gone so luminously for the Galaxy, or arguably for the league. The Beckham Experiment is the title of a new book by Grant Wall, in which he documents what happens when a star who earns $50 million a year, including endorsements, mixes with teammates who eagerly await double coupon days at the Stop and Shop.
You have this Armani world of Beckham coming together with this Walmart world of MLS. And Beckham's temperament over the years suggested that he would be a good teammate, that he would find a way to connect with these guys, even though their skills might not have been that great and their fame was non-existent compared to his.
While his teammates were happy to have their road accommodations upgraded from the Secaucus Sheraton to the Waldorf Astoria, the higher thread count did not translate to more wins. The Galaxy went 3 months without a victory. The failure seemed especially hard on Landon Donovan. Before David Beckham's arrival, Donovan was the Galaxy's captain, biggest star, and best player. After Beckham, only the last of those superlatives held true, says Grant Wall.
I think he became very frustrated in the second half of 2008 that Beckham's effort surprisingly lagged on the field, and that Beckham, he thought, checked out on the team and wasn't committed to the team during that
Donovan
time.
Donovan let his feelings be known through Wall's book. Beckham criticized Donovan's openness as unprofessional. Before last night's game, they swore they had patched things up. One game is not a referendum. One game against the Red Bulls, even less so. But last night, Beckham played well enough, and Donovan scored a goal and assisted on another. In the post-game press conference, Beckham embraced Donovan with words, just as he had embraced him on the field after his goal.
When Landon's in the form that he has been, you know, you just give players like that the ball. And when you give them the ball, you know, they do what they can do and show how good they are. And, you know, Landon did that tonight.
Beckham, having delivered a beautiful crossing pass, was rewarded as Donovan rocketed the compliment home.
He understands how to play the game. He knows how I play, and he can make all the plays that I need to get the ball in a good spot, so it's easy.
Easy hasn't been an apt word to describe the Beckham experiment thus far, but with the Galaxy sitting in third place, a new chapter just might be in the offing. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.
Following the nationwide debate over health care through the experiences of people in one Maryland county, Howard County, near Baltimore. Lisa Jawless has a stake in this discussion in several ways. She and her husband own a small business, so they're affected by the employer mandate that's in the House Democrats' bill. And their small business is an insurance brokerage, so they're very directly affected by it. Welcome back to the program, Lisa Jawless.
Thank you.
And first, talk to me. As a small business owner with a payroll, the requirement is to provide health insurance or pay a penalty if your payroll is over a quarter of a million, and it goes up to 8% if you have a $400,000 payroll. Would any of that change the way you do business with your own employees?
Well, not us personally, except that the provision, I think what most employers do is they obviously try to provide insurance at least for the employee. I see more employers that are providing it. We pay a good percentage, almost all of the employee portion, but we do not pay towards dependents. Part of that mandate is that we're also responsible for contributing a portion towards dependents.
And you think a lot of small businesses that employ people around you in Howard County would have a problem with that?
Possibly. It depends on how you want to allocate your resources. In other words, you know, if we're going to say we're going to contribute $500 towards their employee benefits, well, that's medical, dental, disability, short-term, whatever we're contributing. So we can only slice it and dice it so many ways.
Can you imagine small businesses trying to game these limits? That is, if you can get your payroll down by calling some people who are now employees independent contractors or form smaller
companies. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we had a company recently that just, they you know, had a meeting. They told everyone we can't afford it anymore. And then what they're doing now is they did have another company that was, you know, kind of a dormant Maryland incorporated company. They're bringing that in. They're putting the two owners on there and two other employees, key employees that they wanted to cover, and they'll find ways around it.
Okay. I can see that small businesses with tight payrolls would resist the idea that they have to contribute more toward their employees' insurance. But on the other hand, right, you're an insurance brokerage. All those healthy 20-somethings out there are subject under the House bill to an individual mandate. The market of people who are going to be having to buy health insurance would, in theory, increase under this bill. Wouldn't you get more business that way?
yes, if you sell individually and group insurance, definitely. That's the basic premise that I would think needs to happen, because obviously if everybody is covered, then we don't have the problem with people using the emergency rooms as their doctors and other people paying for it. We also have less adverse selection. So we have more people for the insurance companies to insure, which spreads the risk more. I mean, it solves a tremendous amount of issues.
What about the idea of the public health insurance plan?
Well, I don't know that it would operate like they think it would. I mean, we think it would obviously decrease competition because we think that it would kind of be an unlevel playing field.
You just assume that a public health insurance plan would be marketed through, I don't know who, the Social Security Administration or the regional HHS office, not through commercial insurance brokers.
That's the way that I'm interpreting it. And I don't want to create too much offense here, but if you want something that you can, you know, purchase from 9 to 5 and off on weekends and off on government holidays, I mean, that's going to be our government system.
Well, Lisa Jawless, thank you very much for talking with us once again.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
That's Lisa Jawless of Jawless Insurance in Ellicott City, Maryland, which is in Howard County, where we've been following the progress of the healthcare debate.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, painting the town white. Yeah, but first, you know, the immune system is a complex beast with many parts that all need to work together to keep you well. And understanding how this system all fits together is not very easy. Our next guest has identified a gene that helps control the way our bodies fight off disease. He says this finding may have important implications for vaccine research and for the treatment of autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis. The research is reported in this week's journal Science. Shane Crotty is professor in the Vaccine Discovery Division at the La Jolla Institute for Allergy and Immunology in La Jolla, California. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks.
Hi. Is it possible to succinctly describe our immune system and how it works?
Next question. I'm part of a group that includes some other scientists who are non-immunologists, and we'll talk to each other about our scientists, and they always complain about the immunology as being so complicated that it's tough to follow. So I don't think you can explain how the whole immune system works succinctly, but in terms of I think vaccines, which, I'm a vaccine guy. I'm interested in vaccines. And it's because, you know, they're powerful medicine. They save millions of lives a year.
Yeah.
And at least for this aspect of how the immune system works, really almost all vaccines work by protective antibodies. Okay, so your immune system can do a lot of different things, but one of those things is make antibodies. And what we know is, well, we've got about 25 different human vaccines, okay, and about 23 of them work by protective antibodies.
What are protective antibodies?
Your immune system's job is to protect you from infectious diseases, and so what antibodies will do is that if you get infected with, say, the flu, your body makes antibodies that will bind to those flu viruses, and effectively by just binding to the virus and just completely covering it in antibody, it kills the virus or stops it from doing anything. And your
simple
body will do that for whatever virus or bacteria you get infected with, basically.
Mm-hmm. And so you have to have the body to recognize the virus and then to attack it.
Yes.
That's the whole ball of wax.
Succinctly, yes.
Your work involves finding a gene that helps this process, right?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
So we want to make new vaccines, right? And we just haven't been very good at it.
Yeah.
And why? Well, vaccine development is just, it's always been a very trial and error process. It really hasn't been very much driven by our knowledge of the immune system. My lab and certainly many others have been trying to fill those gaps. And so what we've said is, okay, well, you know, what do you want? You want protective antibodies. So, well, how do you get those? Well, you need helper T cells, which are also called CD4 T cells, or I might just call them helper cells.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you say, okay, so then what do you need those helper T cells to do? Or which helper T cells do you need? And so what's been known is that there are like four different kinds of helper T cells, okay, or four flavors of helper T cells. And each of these are, they're specialized for different functions. So these helper T cells are very powerful regulators of the immune system. Your immune system can do many different things, and each of these four types of helper T cells is sort of specialized for controlling different parts. And the problem was none of these four known types of helper T cells, these four flavors, none of those are specialized for helping get antibody responses. And if you're somebody like me who's interested in vaccines, where you're like, well, I want to know how to get antibody responses, so what's going on here? And so either all four kinds of these cells, they can all do it, right? Mm-hmm. Or there was a fifth type, and we were missing something. And so that's sort of where we've been stuck for probably about 10 years, with a bunch of fighting back and forth about, you know, what might be right. And, you know, a Nobel Prize winner once said, you know, that there are two kinds of scientists. There are lumpers and there are dividers. So the lumpers try and come up with a theory of everything, right, connect everything together, and dividers try and break everything down and figure out, well, what's specialized to exactly do what. And so there was a lot of that argument going on. And so we said, well, look, if there really is this fifth kind, then there should be a gene, a single gene, that turns on that type of CD4. And we said that because, well, that's the way it was for the other four types. So we know there are these other four types, and one of these really fascinating things about the immune system is that for each of those other four types, there's a master gene, a master regulator gene is what we call them.
Right. So you're looking for that gene for the fifth time.
Right.
And you found
it. That's what we found.
You found it. And that... How did you know that? How do you know that you found it? Do you turn it on and watch it make the parts that you need?
Exactly. You know, that's why you do experiments. We in fact had multiple guesses for what might be the gene, and so, but yeah. we had to do experiments to figure out which one was the right one. And we knew when we found the right one because if we turn on that gene, now all of a sudden all of those helper cells become that fifth type, that kind that helps you get a good antibody response. And so now if we did that in the animal, all of a sudden we got a great antibody response and all the helper cells were of this one kind. And so that was sort of the on switch, right? That mm-hmm. gene was the on switch for this specialized cell type. Mm-hmm. And what happens is you turn on that one gene and then that one gene basically controls a program, okay? And so it will basically, you turn on that one gene and then it'll go and activate all of the specialized functions that cell has to do.
Right. Every good site also has a bad site. I mean,
oh yeah.
Right. So if you found something that turned on this gene, you must be fine. You must have found something that turned it off, right?
So that's one of the things we really got quite excited about in the work was that basically we also found effectively the opposite gene. There's a gene that could turn the whole thing off, and then we found a gene that could turn this specific type of cell off. And what was really nice about that was by studying that process, we could actually show that this was important, that this fifth type, it didn't just happen to be in the right place at the right time. You really have to have that type to get a good antibody response because if we flip this off switch, if we forcibly turn on this off switch gene, or in fact what we just did was we just added that gene so that it was just on, gene was present all the time, so then you had this off switch. Now you no longer got these helper cells, and you no longer got an antibody response, and so when we, for example, gave a mouse a virus infection, now they no longer made antibodies to the virus. Uh-huh. And so by doing so, we could show, okay, you absolutely have to have this kind of cell. And so, therefore, that the gene that turns, you know, the gene you have to turn on to get those cells, now we know that that's important for the kind of vaccine design we do.
Well, now that you have the gene, you know which one to turn it on, can you make more powerful vaccines?
We think so. I mean, so, you know, what I would say is that, you know, it took us 4 years to do these experiments, and the immune system is certainly a very complex network, so it'll certainly take that long or longer, you know, to make medical applications. But we really do, we're quite convinced that this is a central thing we needed to know along the path. You know, if we're going to switch from this situation where we've been doing, you know, truly trial and error vaccine design to something that's a more rational vaccine design or more sort of an engineering project, this is a key thing we needed to know so that this wasn't a black box.
Mm-hmm. Can you make use of the other gene that turns it off, too?
Yeah, and so, in fact, I'm a vaccine guy, and so as a result, I generally am trying to do experiments or design things to where you get a really strong immune response. But there are just as many people who study autoimmune diseases and where you want to turn the immune system off. And that's basically
like arthritis, things like that.
Right, like arthritis. So, you know, your immune system's job is to protect you against infectious diseases, to recognize and attack infections. But, you know, as we were saying, the immune system is very complex, and frankly, sometimes it gets confused, and the immune system attacks your body, and that's an autoimmune disease. And so in that case, your immune system is making antibodies instead of making antibodies against the flu, right? Your body's making antibodies against itself and causing damage. Mm-hmm. And so, and that's the kind of case where you get rheumatoid arthritis or certain other autoimmune diseases. And so in those cases, you want to be able to turn the immune system off. And in fact, my collaborator at Yale, Joe Kraft, I mean, his specialty is really rheumatoid arthritis, and that's how he got into this whole problem, was really the whole flip side of the coin. Sometimes we want to be able to turn on antibody production, and sometimes you really want to be able to turn it off.
And so now you can do both of it.
Yep. Piece of cake.
Hey, what's 4 years? But so does that mean that there's a whole that you think you've identified all the genes here? You said you got five of them.
So
is that a complete thing? Is that the set? We need a six pack. I mean, you know, where are we with this?
Yeah, it's a great question, and really, to some extent, it comes back to these lumpers and dividers. You know, people are certainly constantly proposing there are additional subsets or types or flavors, and other people are saying, no, that's not really a different kind. That's the same as this other kind. It's just kind of tweaked, you know, and it has a little bit of a different function. There's certainly no gaping holes left. This one had been a big question because, you know, we know making antibodies is a big part of what the immune system does, and there's some helper cell that needed to be involved in that.
All right. So you've closed that hole. I want to thank you for taking time to be with us, and good luck to you.
Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome. Shane Crotty, professor in the Vaccine Discovery Division at the La Jolla Institute for Allergy and Immunology. Of course, that's in La Jolla, California. We're going to take a break, come back, and switch from the body to a little bit of material science. Some guest we had on over almost a dozen years ago with an update on his research about using fiber optics. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, President Obama addressed the nation's oldest civil rights group at its centennial celebration last night. We'll get a review from the chairman of the board, Julian Bond, and we talked to Thomas Sines. He was just named president of another leading civil rights group, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. That's a little later. But first, Michelle Rhee, the chancellor of D.C. Public Schools. Over the course of the year, we've been checking in on her efforts to improve the performance of the district's traditionally low performing school system. Rhee's and the district's efforts matter, not just because this is the nation's capital, but also because many of the debates over how best to prepare students of all backgrounds and achievement levels are playing out here. Well, new test scores are just in, and she's with us now to talk about them. Welcome back. Thank you for joining us again.
Thank you.
Now, here's the headline. Big gains in the elementary grades. Almost half the students tested were deemed proficient in reading and math. That's a big improvement from 2007 when you first arrived, when fewer than a third were. But some might say only half the kids are proficient. So How do you want us to interpret these scores? Is the glass half full or half empty?
I think it's a little of both. The bottom line is that if you think about our overall proficiency, only about half of our kids are at grade level, and that's unacceptable. So we still have a really far way to go. But on the other side, if you look at where we started, when we came in, only 29% of elementary students were on grade level or above in mathematics. So 29% to 49% in 2 years is a pretty significant jump. So we're pleased with the progress, but we still know how far we have to go.
The other headline, the achievement gap between black and white students, which had been huge, is narrowing. The gap was closed across all grade levels and subject areas, and in secondary math, students close 20 percentage points from 70% to 50%. Why do you think that is?
Well, because our district is so heavily minority students, you know, about 90% of our kids are children of color. When the district overall sees significant gains, then we are going to see a closure of that gap. So we're really thrilled at the fact that we've been able to really focus on making sure that the color of a child's skin doesn't determine their academic achievement levels. But the fact still remains that we've narrowed that gap, that the gap is still significant. It's still at 50% at the secondary level, so we still have a lot of work to do.
There's a story in the Washington Post today that says that some of the gains resulted from test-taking strategies like intensive preparation for children on the cusp of proficiency, evaluating the lists carefully to make sure that kids are removed who are not eligible to take the test. Now, the report makes clear that there's nothing unethical about this. For example, middle-class parents do things like schedule SATs for the time of day that their child is most effective in taking the test. But some people would look at that and say, you know, this is the problem with education today. It's all about the test. It's not about learning. The tests just play too big of a role in learning, if that's what you have to do.
I disagree. I mean, you know, last year when we had big test score gains, people said, well, it's not really about the new administration. It's the leftovers from the old administration. And this year they're saying something else. And the thing that I'm most disappointed by in all of these analyses is that there is an assumption when you actually see our kids improve that it cannot be because they're actually learning more. There must be some other reason. And I think that's incredibly insulting to our children and to our teachers and our schools that have worked so incredibly hard over the last 2 years. I'm hoping that maybe 5 or 6 years from now, when we continue to see gains, people will actually attribute it to the fact that the children are learning more. But in the interim, you know, people are going to have their theories.
What are they working more at?
I think that our big focus has been on the differentiation of instruction. So looking at every kid as an individual learner, understanding what their strengths and weaknesses are, what skills and knowledge they have and they need. And if you can track every child individually and look at what interventions do you need to be able to grow this child's skill base, that can really have a significant impact on the overall achievement levels, not only of a classroom, but of a school and a district.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. As part of our summer education series, we're speaking with Michelle Reese. She's the chancellor of the Washington, D.C. school system. Charter schools, a huge story in Washington, D.C. and around the country. There are some 60 charter schools in this relatively small city, and the debate is over whether charter schools really deliver a better result than traditional public schools or just a different result. Have you assessed whether, particularly in these latest test scores, whether the scores were different for charter schools?
Well, if you look at the secondary level, the charter schools continue to see very strong growth. And so that's, I think, something that the charters can be very proud of. At the elementary level, for the first time, I think, in a long time that people can remember, DCPS actually outperformed the charter schools at the elementary level in both reading and math. And I think lots of people want to take that and say, see, the charters aren't so good. But I think that you have to look beyond that because at the individual school level, you can see some charter schools that are doing absolutely amazing things where 80, 90% of their kids are proficient, and then you have other schools that are actually dragging that average down. So I think that one of the things that the charter school community is focused on now is how they can bring more accountability to the individual schools to help the lower performing schools improve, but if they can't, to close them down.
The Education Secretary Arne Duncan, who came from Chicago, has been vocal lately in saying that one of the things that he wants to do is replicate what works around the country. If you were advising him, or if you were advising him to take a look at what you're doing here in Washington, D.C., what would you think he should focus on? And is there anything over the last couple of years that you should, that you would say, oh, that didn't work so well, leave that alone?
Well, I think that we're still a ways away from being able to serve as a model for any other school districts. We have done a tremendous amount in 2 years to try to really speed up the progress in the city, but I would say we're not yet at a point where we know exactly what works and what needs to happen. I certainly think that the closure of the schools was an important piece to what we were doing because—
I mean, closing under-enrolled— Buildings, schools
correct.
That were under-enrolled had less than the full complement of students in there.
That's
right. Closed some of those, and
part of the reason why is because lots of school districts across the country really hesitate to close schools because it's a politically very unpopular process. So no one wants to close schools. The result here in D.C. of those school closures, though, was that we were able to utilize those resources in a much more effective way. So as a product of the school closures, we were able to make sure that last year, for the first time since anyone can remember in D.C., every single school in the district had an art teacher, a music teacher, a PE teacher, a librarian, and a full-time nurse. So that was a major accomplishment. And I think if you can have a more efficient and effective use of resources in that way, even though the action might not necessarily be politically palatable to people, it has an increased impact and good results for kids. And that's what's most important at the end of the day.
Is there anything that you would have done differently, looking back over your first 2 years here?
I definitely think that as we think back over the last 2 years, we think we could have done a much better job of proactively communicating our message. I think that we were so busy kind of actually putting our nose down and doing the work that we were letting the newspapers and the media kind of drive the story instead of us, you know, directly going to our parents and to our teachers and saying, this is what we're trying to do and this is why we're trying to do it. And so I think course corrected on that. We're doing a much better job of reaching out directly to these constituents, and it's making a big difference.
Speaking of the media, is it true that you won't speak to the local reporter who covers the school system from the Washington Post? Is that true?
No, it's not true.
What's that about?
In fact, we met the other day, and we're trying to get on a much better track. You know what? I think that for
The reason this story, of course, attained some interest is that you are a national figure. You're the chancellor of a local school system, but there's tremendous national interest in what you're doing here, as we've discussed, partly because of the innovations you're trying to bring, and also the fights you're having are fights that a lot of school officials are having, mm-hmm. How to pay teachers. Do you continue with some of the systems like tenure that have been in place for so many years? What kinds of changes do you make? But it does... Well, anyway, you finished that story. So.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that we have to do is be much more proactive about the messages that we're sending and the stories that come out. And certainly for any school district official, they'll tell you that the press can be a very frustrating entity to deal with. But I think that the bottom line is that the district overall has benefited from a lot of the national press that we've got. Certainly there have been frustrating times as well, but that's part of the job. You take the good with the bad and you try to manage against that the best that you can. I think people are really interested, not just in the city, but across the country in what's happening here. And our goal is just to make sure that gets communicated in an accurate and balanced way.
Finally, you have been quoted in one of those national outlets, Time Magazine, saying that the children of Washington, D.C. have been receiving an education that every single citizen in this country should be embarrassed by. What about now? You still feel that way?
Yeah, I still feel that the vast majority of our children in this city are not getting the education they deserve, and that if you look at their achievement levels, it is absolutely not a reflection of what their abilities and aptitude is, and it's more a reflection of the dysfunction and the way that the district has operated in the past in a way that has not served those kids well. I think we are making tremendous progress in that area. I think that those numbers don't reflect some of the incredibly hard work that teachers and principals and other people have put into it. But overall, in the big picture, we're still nowhere near saying that we are providing every child in the city with an excellent education.
Michelle Rhee has just wrapped up her second year
as
Chancellor of Washington, D.C.'s public schools. We hope we'll speak again.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us here in our studios in Washington.
Thanks.